John 20:30, the 13th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of John, was presented by Ron Julian on September 14, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Hey, good morning. This is the last in our series on the Gospel of John. In this series, we've tried to get the big picture. I've tried to kind of go for an overview of John's purpose in the Gospel. I have skipped by some of the details to try to sort of build this big picture. Well, as it happens, there is a sentence in the Gospel of John that I think he intends to be a very clear summary statement of his purpose in the Gospel. And it's kind of been my intention all along from the beginning to end this series by looking at that sentence and basically using it as a framework, a way of looking back on what it is that John has done in this gospel, because I think it's actually a very, very accurate and succinct statement of what it is that he's trying to do. That sentence is found in John chapter 20, verse 30. Now, if you've been following in our series, you'll notice that we have talked about most everything in John except the very beginning and the very end. When we started, I deliberately skipped the prologue, and we started right into the account of John the Baptist, and we haven't talked yet about the death and resurrection of Christ as it's described in the end of the gospel. So I want to do something a little different to wrap up our series today. This will probably be a total fiasco, but I'm going to try to look at our target sentence here, 20:30, to use it as a way of reviewing what it is that John is doing in the gospel, and then I want to pick up as we go along and look at that bits from the prologue and from the end to tie together, because in both the beginning and the end we see these same themes as we have seen throughout the gospel. So my hope at the end of this is that at a minimum you will be able to go away for the entire rest of your life, and when you read chapter 20, verse 30 of John, you'll say, yep, that's it. I know what he's talking about there. Well, we'll see. And I'll try to do better, because we're going to be dancing around a little bit. I'm going to try to do better to give you the verse references this week than I did last week. So, chapter 20, verse 30. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to go through this statement a phrase at a time, because every phrase in it is actually quite rich and significant of what he has been doing through the whole book. So we'll do that and try to kind of paint this picture as we go along. So our first phrase here: many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed. And if you've been with us, you've seen that the Gospel of John is a book about signs. Signs being these miracles which signify. They send a message. And the message is that God is with this man, Jesus. This man, Jesus, who is standing in front of you, has just healed a lame man, he has just raised the dead or whatever, and the question is, how did he do that? And the way he did that is that God is behind his message. God is the one who is doing these things and indicating that you need to listen to him. John says here that there are many other signs that Jesus did besides the one that John records, but John has told us a number of things. We first saw Jesus tell Nathanael what he had been doing as he sat under a tree far away from where Jesus was. We saw Jesus turn the water into wine. We saw him heal the sick and the lame and the blind. He knew the details of the life of the woman at the well without having ever met her before. He fed 5,000 people with just a few loaves and fishes. He walked on the water. And the most profound miracle that we saw before his arrest, the one that really precipitated his arrest, was the raising of Lazarus from the dead. But the greatest sign of all that he performed was the one that he performed at the end of John. He rose from the dead. He had spoken of it before. The Jews had asked him for a sign early in the book of John, and he said, okay, I'll give you a sign. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And John tells us that he was speaking metaphorically. He was speaking of his body when he spoke of the temple. And in the end, that's exactly the sign that Jesus performed. He was arrested and executed, and in 3 days he rose again. So we know from John at least one of the purposes of Christ's death and resurrection. It was to serve as the greatest of the signs that he did. When we have Jesus saying to Nathanael, oh, when you were under the tree far away over there, I saw you, that's like God whispering, you should pay attention to him, this is my son. When Jesus is raised from the dead, this is God shouting, this is my son. Not even death could hold him. So a key part of John's story is it is a record of these miraculous signs that indicate something about who Jesus was. Okay, so let's go back to our summary sentence then, chapter 20, verse 30. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples. And there's our second key phrase. The disciples have played a very important role in John's gospel. They're the ones who have been given the task of explaining to us what Jesus is all about. We did not see him. I have never in my life seen Jesus. I have not seen him raise one person from the dead. I have not seen him walk on the water. I don't even know what he looks like. But the apostles saw him. The disciples saw him. Jesus didn't write anything down. So how am I going to know anything about what he did and what he taught and understand the significance of what he did? Well, he appointed his disciples to be his representatives. Why do we know what John the Baptist testified about Jesus? He didn't write anything down either. Well, it's because several of the disciples of Jesus were there with John the Baptist and heard him testify as to who Jesus was. These same disciples saw all the miraculous signs that Jesus did. They heard his teaching. They didn't understand a lot of it at first, but they heard it. They saw the arguments that he had with the Pharisees. They heard Jesus in the upper room explain their role as apostles, the role that he was calling them to fulfill. And then when Jesus is crucified and rose again, as we see in the end of John, their role is crucial. They are the witnesses to all of this. They are the ones who saw him suffer and die, and they're the ones who saw him rise again. Notice how John reports the details of these events. And let me just give you an example in chapter 20, verse 1. Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen clothes lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen clothes lying there, and the face cloth which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen clothes, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. So John himself is this other disciple that is described. He never speaks of himself in the first person. He never says, I did this. He doesn't name himself by name, but it's always the other disciple or the disciple who Jesus loved or just this disciple. I mean, but whenever he doesn't name somebody, it's a safe bet that he's talking about himself. So the level of detail reflects here the fact that he was there, that he saw all this stuff. I mean, he can tell you, we were running together, but I got there first, and I looked in, but I didn't go in. But then Peter arrived afterwards, and he went in, and then I followed him afterwards. I mean, this is the account of somebody who saw it. This is either the account of somebody who's writing a novel, who's making the whole thing up from beginning to end, or else this is the account of somebody who can tell us all that detail because he was there. He was one of those two guys. It is to the disciples, among others, that Jesus reveals himself finally in 2019. On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you." And remember, the word apostle means the one who has been sent. Okay, so John can tell us that Jesus was alive because he was there. He saw him. He was in that room when he showed up. And he reports that Jesus repeats this commission that he had given to the disciples. They were going to be the ones that he sends, his apostles, to represent him to the world. The Gospel of John ends with a scene that shows how important Jesus saw the role of the disciples to be. Jesus has returned from the dead now at the end of John and is with the disciples in Galilee. And in chapter 21, verse 15, we see this. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to them, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Okay, now there's a lot we could talk about with this passage, and many make a big deal about that there are different Greek words for love that are being used here, which I think is not significant actually at all. And a variety of things we could talk about. I just want to highlight one thing here that in the context of John I think is very significant. It's really why John has told us this story. Jesus uses this metaphor, "feed my sheep." And of course, he's not telling him to go and put food in the trough for Jesus' flock of sheep that he has on a hill somewhere. It's a metaphor for he wants him to teach his people. Jesus is leaving, and Peter and the other disciples are taking on the task of being the ones who are the shepherds of the sheep. They are the ones who are going to instruct and encourage and exhort the people of Jesus. So Jesus is telling Peter, if you love me, then you will love the ones that I love. That is, you will teach them and encourage them as I would have done if I were here. He asks him three times, "Do you love me?" And in each time, the answer is, "Well, if that's the case, if you love me, then you take care of my people." That's who Peter and the other apostles are to us. The apostles are those whom Jesus left behind to show his love for us. We're the sheep that he's talking about there, by teaching us what he would have taught if he were here. So although I don't have one word written by Jesus, I have the teaching of Jesus passed on to me through the disciples, including Peter. Okay, so In our summary sentence so far, we've seen that Jesus performed signs and that the disciples were the witnesses of those signs. And that was their role, to be the witnesses of those signs. Let's look at our sentence again. 20:30. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written. And I'll stop there. That's the next phrase that I want to look at. The idea that these signs seen by the disciples have been written in this book fits with one of the greatest themes in the book of John, the idea of testimony. It is one of the huge themes in this book. You and I have not seen Jesus. What we have is a book with the testimony of John that he saw and heard these things happen. The testimony of John is what we're relying on. And that's why this book, in his book, he tells story after story that explores the notion of testimony. The testimony of those who are telling others about Jesus or about God. Notice right in the very beginning, in the prologue, 1:6, there came a man sent from God whose name was John. This is John the Baptist. He came for a witness, that he might testify of the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came that he might testify of the light. So almost the first thing in the gospel, we're 6 verses in, and we're talking about testimony. And here it's the testimony of John the Baptist. John the Baptist told what God had told him. He told him, this is how you will recognize the Messiah. And then he testifies, and that's exactly what happened with this guy, Jesus. See him, that guy there? That's the one that God told me about. And how do we know then what John the Baptist testified? Because he never wrote it down anywhere. We know because John the Apostle testifies to us that that's what John said. And so because we depend on the written testimony of the apostles, over and over again, John is exploring in the life of Jesus the way this theme of testimony comes up and emerges in various ways. Jesus often speaks of testifying to what he knows from the Father. The Father has given it to him. We don't have access to the Father to get it directly from him, but Jesus testifies to us as to what God has said. The Father testifies through the signs that Jesus is the Son, by doing these miracles, and that is said often. The woman at the well testifies that Jesus was a miraculous prophet, and the people in the town believe because of her testimony. She goes off and tells them, look at what he did. And yet when they hear Jesus for themselves, they say, now it is not just because of your testimony, now we have seen it for ourselves. And so this exploring this theme of hearing it from somebody else versus seeing it directly, and how you might believe in both cases. The man born blind, after Jesus is gone, but he is testifying now, it is this man Jesus who made me see. Those who saw Lazarus raised from the dead start going all around Jerusalem, it is said, testifying to others as to what they had seen, which creates this huge furor in Jerusalem over Jesus. All in all, some form of the word testify or testimony occurs over 60 times in the Gospel of John. Not to mention then other words like report, message, or word, which are basically talking about the same thing, somebody's word or message or report of what it is that happened. This theme continues into the end of the gospel. John emphasizes, for example, that the account of Jesus' death is eyewitness testimony. If we look in chapter 19, verse 31. Since it was the day of preparation, and so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who had been crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs, But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once there came out blood and water. Now, 35. He who saw it has testified. His testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, that you also may believe. You see the emphasis here. John saying, and again, it's in the third person, but I think it's clear that it's John himself that's saying these things. I saw this with my own eyes. He was dead. They came up to him. He was already dead. He stabbed him, and the signs of death, the blood and water that came out, I saw it with my own eyes. I'm here to tell you, this is what happened. One of the most fascinating passages dealing with testimony is found right at the end of John in chapter 20, starting in verse 24. This is a famous story. You probably know it. But in 20:24, now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples, this is after Jesus has been raised. And the other disciples have seen Jesus, but Thomas hasn't. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will not believe." 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed." So there's much that is fascinating to us in this story. Jesus seems to walk through walls. Jesus still has the marks of crucifixion on him, interestingly, even though he has been raised from the dead. Thomas gives this soul-stirring cry, "My Lord and my God," which is something I have thought about a lot in my life. But notice in the context of John that the key idea here that fits this theme that John has been exploring with us is the idea of testimony and belief. Thomas has heard the testimony of the other disciples about the resurrection, but he can't believe it yet. He hasn't seen it. The other disciples that he has known for years have said to him, "We've seen him. He's alive." He's saying, "No, I can't buy that yet." He says he has to see it. And so then he does see it, and he believes. And he says, "My Lord and my God." And then kind of the whole point of this story, I think, is summed up in Jesus' response to him. Jesus says, "Oh, it's because you saw me that you believed, huh? That's why you're believing now. Well, blessed are those who have not seen and have believed." And we know, of course, that Jesus is talking about us. I mean, we're the ones who have not seen and yet believed. John's readers are in that position. They haven't seen, and yet John is asking them to believe this story. And so he tells this story about Jesus speaking to that very issue. This is the theme that John is so fascinated with throughout the gospel. "I know you're believing because I tell you that this is what's going on. So let me tell you a story about somebody who heard the testimony about Jesus." I don't think Thomas is being portrayed as a bad guy here. It's understandable how he would respond to this. I don't think he's being portrayed as an unbeliever. I don't like the fact that we always call him Doubting Thomas, because, I mean, everyone was, "What? What's going on when this happened?" I mean, nobody heard this and said, "Oh, yeah, that was obvious. I saw that coming." So, but this story illustrates the problem that John is well aware of and that he's been exploring through the whole gospel. John's readers are in Thomas' position. We haven't heard the testimony of the disciples. I mean, we have heard the testimony of the disciples, but we haven't seen for ourselves what they're talking about. And Jesus himself says here, he's implying here, he recognizes the difficulty of this. That's a challenging thing, to believe this based on testimony. That's why it is a blessing from God to be one who believes the testimony of the disciples, even though you haven't seen it for yourself? And on what basis would we believe, even though we haven't seen? It's the testimony of those who did see it. That's what the basis on which we're being asked to believe it. This theme of testimony takes us right to the very end of the book, the next to the last verse in John 21:24. This is the disciple who is testifying about these things and who has written about these things, and we know that his testimony is true. This is kind of a summation of the whole book. This disciple that was just mentioned there, who is John, it's his testimony that we're going on for this whole thing. And we know that his testimony is true. You haven't seen it, but John was there. He saw it. He's telling you about it. And he's saying, I'm telling you the truth in what I saw. Okay, so in our summary sentence so far, we see that this gospel is about the signs that Jesus did, which were witnessed by the disciples, which was their role, and then passed on to us through written testimony. Let's go back to our summary sentence again, chapter 20, verse 30. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written that you may believe. What is the point of all this testimony? That we would believe what we have been told. That's the huge theme in the Gospel of John. The question of, are you going to believe or not, based on what you have heard and what you have seen? The theme of belief starts from the very first chapter in John, in 1:7. Why is it that John the Baptist testified? It is so that all might believe through him. In 1:12, who are the ones who are the children of God? Those who believe in his name, that is, in the name of Jesus. Each of us who hears this gospel faces a choice. Will we believe it or not? This is a central part of Christianity, but it is kind of a strange and puzzling thing. Why does it matter what we believe? I mean, how did it come to be that my destiny as a human being depends on what I believe about what happened in history? Well, a crucial part of John's purpose in this gospel is to explore why it is important whether we believe this story or not. Throughout the Gospel of John, the nature of belief and unbelief are explored in a very rich and dynamic way. He comes at it from a lot of different angles, with a lot of different stories about people who saw things and heard things and either believed or did not believe, and whether they continued to believe after they first believed. On the one hand, we can lose count of how many times that we encounter in John, Jesus does a miracle or he teaches something or something along those lines, and the response is, and so-and-so believed. This happens over and over through John. As it happens, some form of the word believe occurs 85 times in the Gospel of John. The disciples believed. The crowds believed. The Samaritans believed. The blind man believed. And on the other hand, we have this ongoing theme, starts very early in John and runs throughout the whole book, the tragic picture of the unbelief of the Jewish leadership. It starts in chapter 1, I think, in the prologue, verse 11. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. So right from the prologue, from the very beginning, we see this theme that Jesus comes and his own will not accept him. And throughout John, we see this unwillingness of the Jewish leaders to accept Jesus. It ends in this heartbreakingly ironic picture in chapter 19:12. This is at Jesus, now he's before Pilate, and his destiny is being determined. So in 19:12, from then on, Pilate sought to release Jesus, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So the king, the Messiah, the promised Davidic king, is standing before the Jews and especially the Jewish leadership here, but they yell out, "He's not our king. We have no king but Caesar." Now, we want to understand this. We don't want to think of them too harshly. In a way, I don't know that they believe it all that much, what they're saying at that spot. What they know is that if Rome gets the idea that Jesus is leading some kind of insurrection, is claiming to be king and gathering followers to make him king, the Romans will come in and wipe them out. So they're trying to keep Pilate happy. This is the representative of Rome here. King, he's not our king. I mean, they're saying that because they want to get rid of him and they don't want to get in trouble with the Romans. So, no, he's not our king. But the tragedy is, of course, that he is. And that's the great irony of the picture there. So, throughout the gospel, we have these stories of belief and unbelief. That's what the Gospel of John is talking about. The picture of belief that John paints is not a simple one. What's striking is that many people are described as believing at some point or another, but many of those who are described as believing end up taking off in the end and not being interested. There was a mob of people following Jesus after he fed the 5,000. They were ready to make him king. They were excited. They were ready to go. And yet, in the space of a day's time, most of them went away, saying, "No, we're not interested. This guy's weird." John explores this in his gospel. Why is this? Why does this happen? Why is it so hard to believe, even when it's right there in front of you? You see miracle after miracle, and yet somehow your response is, "No, I don't buy it. This isn't for me." Well, Jesus does a lot of teaching on that subject in the Gospel of John. What is the root of unbelief and belief? On the one hand, he talks about how unbelief is rooted in our deepest desires and commitments. Jesus says that we don't believe because we are unwilling to admit that we're evil. He says we don't believe because we want the approval of men more than we want the approval of God, and so on. This is one of the great insights that we take from Jesus' teaching in John. It's the idea that what we believe is a matter of our will. It is a matter of what we want. Belief is not something that just automatically happens to you. You see something and say, "Oh, okay, I'll buy that." It has to do with what you're willing to believe, even if the evidence is strong. If you don't want to know it, you won't. So, then on the other hand, it takes the work of God to break through such hardness of hearts. The children of God are the ones who have been born again by the Spirit of God, as described in several places. They are the ones who have been drawn to Jesus by the Father. So, John, in this gospel, by telling these various stories about how people responded to Jesus and showing the teaching that Jesus gave about belief and unbelief in response to that, he has prepared us for the epic personal battle that we face, the decision whether we will believe or not, and portrayed it as a decision that is rooted in our deepest self. It's a reflection of what we ultimately are willing to be about. Okay, so in our summary sentence so far, we've seen that Jesus performed miraculous signs, that these signs were witnessed by the disciples, and then they were passed on to us in written testimony, and the purpose of this testimony is that we might make the choice to believe. Go back to our sentence, 20:30. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. The written testimony is so that we might believe. But believe what? Believe in something? Anything? No, there's a particular thing that this testimony is calling us to believe. John's proclamation is that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, we have to ask ourselves, why is that a significant proclamation? I mean, if I get up and say to you, I have a great proclamation to make. Steve Jobs is the CEO of Apple Computers. Okay, it depends on what you're into, I guess. That might be more or less exciting to some people. Some people get mad about that. Some people get excited about that. But in the end, it's not that big a deal. I mean, it's not going to affect that much. The fact that Steve Jobs is the CEO of Apple probably has dictated that the new iPods have all those cool colors. So that made a difference. They look cool. But in the end, it doesn't affect that much. But the Messiah, the Christ, you have to back up and understand what that means to see the significance of the statement. The Messiah is the anointed one, the promised king of Israel, the one who is going to come and deliver the Jews, the one who had been promised for centuries. But there was still a lot of question as to exactly what is it that the Messiah is about? What am I looking for in a Messiah? What is it that the Messiah in the end has come to do? So maybe a better way to think about it is the other way around. The question isn't so much, who is Jesus? The question is, who is the Christ? And the answer is, the Christ is Jesus. And let me explain what I'm talking about there. What we're interested in is, how would I recognize the Messiah when I saw him? What is the Messiah all about? Why would I be interested in the Messiah? So let's look around for a Messiah. I'm back at the time of Jesus, and I'm scanning the horizon, and I'm looking around, and I see, oh, now there's a guy. He is leading a political uprising against Rome. Maybe that's the Messiah. That's what the Messiah is all about, right? He came to lead a political uprising that will kick out the Romans. Well, no, that's not the Christ. That's not him. That's not what the Christ came to do, at least not initially. Okay, so let's look around. Ah, here I have a great religious leader. And this is a rabbi, and he calls on everyone to fast and to eat kosher and to not spit on the Sabbath and all kinds of stuff. And that clearly is the Messiah. There is someone who cares deeply about the law and the things of God. And no, we have to say, well, no, that's not the Christ either. That's not what the Christ was about. That's not what he came to do. Who is it? It's this guy, Jesus. He used to be a carpenter. He wanders around. He's not much to look at. He breaks the Sabbath. Where are his armies? Why are the Romans still beating us up? I mean, what kind of claim would he have to be the Messiah? Why would I be interested in him? Well, that's what John portrays in his gospel. What sort of a Christ is he? What did he come to do in the name of being the Messiah? I've said this before, but I actually, being one who's not real big on tradition and stuff, you probably figured out, I actually like one traditional formulation I find very helpful if you've ever heard Jesus described as prophet, priest, and king. If you've heard that phrase, I think that actually quite well captures what is said about who Jesus is. And John portrays this picture. First of all, he is the greatest of the prophets. He has come from God himself to give us God's message, to bring light into the darkness. We see this right from the beginning in the prologue, in verse 9. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. And in 1:18 in the prologue, no one has seen God at any time. The only Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. So, In fact, what we see in John is that we really can't distinguish between the Father and Jesus. What Jesus is saying is, what I'm telling you is what the Father is saying. What I'm saying is what he has given me to say. So our response to Jesus ultimately is our response to God. So he is the greatest of all the prophets, the one who has most completely brought us the message from God and explained to us who God is and what he's doing. Jesus is also the great high priest. And although that language is not used in John, that is very much the picture that is painted. Jesus describes himself as having come to offer up his body for the life of the world. And what we see, of course, in the story of the crucifixion is Jesus as our priest offering himself. He died there for our sins. So in John we see there's another explanation for what the purpose of the cross was. Not only is his death and resurrection the greatest sign that he is indeed the Messiah, but it is actually the offering of his life that ends up bringing life to us. And then Jesus is the great king over all creation. That's what it means to be the Messiah. The Messiah is the anointed one, the anointed king, the king of Israel, and ultimately the king over all, the one who rules over God's kingdom forever. And that's who Jesus is. And we're waiting for that day when he returns and fully establishes that kingdom and openly shows his rule. We can see all of that hinted at in John in various places. In the end of John, in chapter 18:33, where, again, Jesus is before Pilate. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You rightly say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" So here we see Jesus acknowledging his kingship and also claiming to be a prophet from God, the one who has brought the truth from God that all should listen to. And he is saying these things to the man who is going to execute him and thus fulfill his offering of his life as our high priest. John loves to bring out the ironies in Jesus' life, and we see a striking one in John 19:19. So this is now Pilate has decreed, okay, Jesus will be crucified. In 19:19, Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, "Do not write 'the King of the Jews,' but rather, 'This man said, I am the King of the Jews.'" Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." And of course, the great irony is that Pilate didn't mean it. I mean, this is his way of kind of jabbing at the Jews by putting what he did. But in fact, the sign spoke the truth. This was, in fact, the King of the Jews hanging there, dying for their sins. Okay, now, so prophet, priest, and king. I want to make a comment about one other issue in John that is harder to deal with. This is the one that I'm still thinking about as I work through the Gospel of John. I feel like I understand pretty well what's happening in John. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like I do. But this one is very tricky, and I'm still thinking it through. I've said that John portrays Jesus as prophet, priest, and king, and that's absolutely right. But there's another aspect of John's portrayal that is harder to deal with. And that's all these statements that imply the divinity of Christ, that talk about Jesus' equation with the Father. Now, I have no doubt whatsoever that John does this. He does this often. Jesus says in John that he and the Father are one. He says that when we see him, Jesus, we see the Father. Jesus says that he came from heaven and is going back to heaven. So for me, the divinity of Christ is not in question. But the question I'm wrestling with in John is how much Jesus meant to satisfy our curiosity about the metaphysics of all this. And what I mean by that, how much does Jesus tell us about how he and the Father are one? It is very common for the book of John to be used to develop a very specific metaphysical picture of the relationship between the Father and the Son, and all kinds of fancy words get used to describe those relationships and so on. Well, I have nothing against that. That's great. But the problem starts for me with the very first verse in John. Now, this is kind of a side issue here, but I said at the very beginning that I would talk about this, and so I'm going to talk about it, even though I don't have anything to say. But I'm keeping my promise. What does it say? And I'm leaving one particular Greek word untranslated here in the beginning of the prologue. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. This Logos was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by the Logos, and apart from the Logos, nothing came into being that has come into being. In the Logos was life, and the life was the light of men. Okay, now I have no interest in trying to debunk the standard way of interpreting this passage. I have no axe to grind when I come to this. The traditional interpretation would say that the Logos is the second person of the Trinity who was with the first person of the Trinity from the beginning. If that's what John's saying, that's great. I'm there. My problem is that I have not yet convinced myself that I understand what John is saying here. This is a very tricky statement, and the trickiness of it relates to this word logos. What in the heck does it mean? What is he doing with it here? There are at least three things that John could be referring to, and I'll make this brief. This little interpretive exercise here. I'll get back to the main thing in a second, but I just want to make clear to you the nature of the problem. First of all, the word logos was used in Greek philosophy at the time, and there was at this time a Jewish philosopher as well who also talked a lot about the logos. Logos meaning something like the ultimate rationale or reason or plan behind the universe. It's that intelligent purpose that governs and shapes what everything is. This word was used in that way in Greek philosophy at the time and before this time. So we could understand this to be saying something like then, in the beginning was the reason, the rationale, or something like that. Okay, secondly, you'll notice that in the context of John 1, there are these things that sound a little bit like they're hearkening back to Genesis 1. Genesis 1 starts out in the beginning, and John 1 starts out in the beginning. Both of them talk about light and darkness. And we have John saying here, all things came into being through the Word. And there's nothing that didn't come in, that came into being. Yeah, you know that, where he says, nothing that came into being that has come into being, that didn't come into being through the Logos, the Word. Only he says it better, but something like that. Okay, but that idea that everything came into existence through the Word, through the Logos. And Logos, very typically, can mean word, declaration, something that someone says. And what do we see in Genesis 1? We see everything coming into being by God speaking. Let there be light. Let there be this, let there be this. And so we might understand in this concept that the idea of logos is something like, in the beginning was the declaration of God, or something like that. That would make sense in a certain way. But there's another option as well. The word logos is a very common word in the Gospel of John. It's used 36 times in the Gospel of John. And everywhere else in John, it just simply means word or message, the message that somebody says. It's very similar to testimony. We keep seeing about how someone testifies and someone believes them. Well, we see the same thing. Someone believes someone's word. The townspeople believe the word of the woman at the well, if I remember correctly. People believe Jesus' word. People says, you should believe my word, and so on. So this idea of the word as being basically someone's message or testimony is very, very common in John. And so it's very attractive to me to think, gee, I wonder if at the very beginning of the gospel, it means the same thing that it means throughout the rest of the gospel. So in the beginning was the message, or something like that. The problem is, take any one of those three options and try to fit it into the context of John and see how exactly it fits, and it's not easy to see how that stuff works together. So I'm just admitting, when it comes to, this is the most famous thing in the Gospel of John, I just got done teaching the whole Gospel of John to you, I'm saying to you, I think I understand what the Gospel of John is about, but I have no idea what the first four verses are talking about. I cannot convince myself yet that I understand exactly what it is that John is saying there. The important point emerges fairly clearly, I think. In this logos is light and life, and Jesus is this logos, this light, this life made flesh. What we see in him is the one who brings the light and brings life. That's clear. That's who Jesus is. But has John described the details of how the Son and the Father were relating to each other in the beginning? Maybe so, but how has he described that? I don't know. And like I say, I'm not pushing for one particular way of taking it or the other. I'm just looking for a way that makes some sense, and I haven't arrived at it yet. So those kinds of questions, when you explore those places in John, you find that it starts to get complicated. Each of the places where we might go and say, oh yeah, that's obvious what that's talking about, actually when you look at it, it starts to get a little more complicated than you might think. So those are the hardest questions for me in the Gospel of John, but they are related to this message that Jesus is the Christ. They have something to do with telling us who he is as the Messiah of God. But those are the hardest questions to answer, I think. What is clear is that Jesus is the Christ. He is the prophet, the one who speaks for God most clearly. He is the Savior, the one who offered his life for our sin. And he is the King over all creation, who will rule over God's eternal kingdom forever. That's who he is portrayed as being. So, as we look at our summary sentence then, Jesus performed signs that were witnessed by the disciples, who give written testimony, in John's gospel in particular, so that we might make the choice to believe that Jesus is the Christ. Now, we have one more thing to look at. What's the point? Why does it matter whether I believe this testimony that Jesus is the Christ or not? We go back to our sentence and finish it. Chapter 20, verse 30. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. In the end, this is all about escaping condemnation and death and arriving at life. It is all about salvation. In the Gospel of John, Jesus portrays the nature of this salvation in three ways. What is the nature of this life? First of all, we are guilty and we need to escape condemnation. Jesus says that he came to free us from judgment. His people escape judgment. And how does he do that? He tells us that he came to offer up his life on our behalf. That's how he does that. His death on the cross was meant to free us from judgment. So that's an aspect of the life that he's bringing us. Next, we are slaves of sin, he describes us as. That is, we cannot help but be trapped in our own moral corruption. We need to be rescued. And that's a second aspect of the salvation that he described in John. He came to free us so that we are no longer the sorts of people who are trapped in our own sin. And then finally, maybe most obviously, we are prisoners of death. Death has its hold on us. And what Jesus has promised is eternal life, freedom from death. The prologue tells us of these things. In verse 1:4, in the Logos was life, and the life was the light of man. In 1:12, but as many received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. And in 1:17, for the law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. So life and acceptance as God's children and grace, forgiveness, this is what the Logos became flesh in order to bring us. So John's message throughout the gospel is that by believing in him, we arrive at that which we most need. We are guilty and we find forgiveness. We are sinful and we are rescued from our own moral corruption. And we die, but we are rescued from death forever. That's the life that John portrays throughout the gospel as being what Jesus came to bring. Okay, so I want to read you chapter 20, verse 30 one more time. Just think about the themes, how all these themes are tied together in this verse. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. In the end, John's purpose in this book is evangelistic. It is proclaiming the gospel and saying, you should believe this and find life. John is writing many years after these events took place, as I've mentioned before. In fact, he's writing to people who are in a situation, in some ways, that is like our own. Jesus is no longer here on earth for them, and neither is he for us. The other apostles are gone, just as the apostles are gone for us. Even though Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, most of the Jewish people have not accepted him, and people have had to sort out, what does that mean? What's the significance of that? And so John is writing this account. This is my written testimony of what happened. Answering the question, John, why should we listen to you? Why should we care anything about what you have to say? Why should we believe you, and what would be at stake? So what John has to say to them applies to us just as much. He's basically saying, Jesus came and promised life. I saw him and I heard him. He performed many miracles to prove that God was with him, to prove that he could keep his promise of life. I saw these miracles. I heard what he had to say. So you should believe me. You didn't see it, but I did, and my testimony is true. In essence, that's what the Gospel of John is doing. Well, probably know I'm not in the habit of preaching come-to-Jesus sermons, but you can't teach the overall message of the Gospel of John and not preach a come-to-Jesus sermon, because that's what John is doing. I mean, that's the book. That's his purpose. John's message is, here is why you should believe, and if you do believe, you will find life. This is an important message to us, I think, not just at that point where we first make that decision, am I going to believe this stuff or not, but it is continually relevant to us throughout our lives. Deciding to believe in Jesus as our Savior and teacher is not a one-time thing. As you and I face the pressures of life, we are in that same situation that we see the people in John being. there was this initial belief, but then other things come along, and the question is, do I still want this? Is this still what I'm about? Do I still value the promise of eternal life, even in the face of whatever difficulties and suffering I may be going through now? Am I really still counting on this man who was executed 2,000 years ago to solve the problem of my life today? And that's a question that we are continually facing. It's not one that you can settle forever. So John's gospel is the testimony of a man who saw Jesus, who's telling us, yes, you should trust him. I saw it with my own eyes. He is the Christ. Okay, so there's my summary of the Gospel of John. We have a few minutes for any comments or questions you might have. Here. David here.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
On the subject of the testimony of the scriptures and they being our gateway to belief, as testimonies and eyewitnesses that, you know, are saying what they saw and communicating it to us for the purpose of our, you know, heart conversion. These days I have a lot of encounters with people who, along that line of reasoning, get tripped up by, well, what about all these other books that say, you know, I, Judas, am writing this book, and I saw this, or
right.
I, Mary Magdalene, writing this book, and I saw that.
Right.
Or looking at, you know, the canonical gospels and saying, like, well, but there are these little discrepancies, like, okay, when they go to the tomb, here it says there's one person, here it says there's two, and here it says they saw an angel right away, and this one says they didn't see an angel.
Right.
And, okay, well, what am I supposed to make of this if there's these discrepancies and it's so easy to say, I saw this, you know, believe me.
Right.
And how are we to answer those kind of objections?
Right. Yeah, that's a really good question, and there's a lot to it. There are answers that we can give to some of the legitimate questions that people would raise about how do the gospel accounts relate to each other. Let me just give this as an overall comment. What we have noticed in John is that John's purpose has not been to give the full picture of what happened. In fact, if you compare the things that he... In those places where he's talking about the same things that the other Gospels talk about, very often there are a whole bunch of things that he leaves out, and he will focus on a particular thing that is clearly relevant to this theme that he's exploring. It's something that didn't come out in the other accounts, and he wants that to come out. But I think he does it so often that it really... I'm pretty convinced at this point that he is assuming that people have read the other accounts and know the basic story of what's going on and that he is filling in. So in that sense, it wouldn't be surprising. There's much... notice we have Mary Magdalene described as she went to the tomb and she saw he wasn't there, and then she comes back and says to the disciples, Jesus isn't in the tomb and we don't know where they put him. Well, who's this we? Well, and he didn't say anything about anybody being with her, but the only reason he mentions her at all is basically so that he can set up the fact that he goes and tells them, so he can tell the story about how he and Peter ran there and who got there first and all of that stuff. So it does help for us to recognize that there are reasons that would lead to some of what might seem to us to be discrepancies between the accounts. But the larger question is whether what sort of attitude should I take towards these texts? Should I give them the benefit of the doubt at places where it seems like you could take it as these are two conflicting accounts that from people who are obviously not aware of what really went on? And that comes back to the larger question that you're raising. what sort of response should I have to a testimony like this? I mean, you're right. Someone saying, this is what I saw, people can be mistaken. There was the practice of writing in the name of people who, when in fact I'm not the person that I'm writing in the name of at all. So we have to recognize that such a thing did happen. And that's where it comes to it's the overall picture. And I think this is true for our understanding of just the big question of, is there a God at all, and all of that. That it's not any one particular argument that settles it and says, oh yeah, see, that's the deal. What John is saying to us is, this is my testimony, and I'm telling you the truth. Now, the question is, I have to decide whether I'm going to believe that testimony, whether I'm going to give it credence. And that, I can't just believe it because he tells me to, because he asks me to believe what he's saying. But then I have to face that larger question, so is he a credible witness or not? And how does this fit with what I see in the scriptures beforehand? How does this fit? I see others. I see Paul, who, you know, virtually all scholars that I'm aware of would agree that there is this core of letters, Romans and Corinthians and those things, that are clearly written by Paul at the time that they are claimed to have been written. And so how does what I see in John fit with what Paul tells me about his calling as an apostle and what he knows about what Jesus did and so on? So, and then on a larger level, I have to ask myself the question, in my culture, the people who are most likely to balk at the testimony here, they have a certain worldview. They have a way of looking at the world and what they think is plausible and not plausible. And I have to ask myself, does that worldview make sense? I inherited that worldview. I grew up thinking that anybody who would believe this stuff in the Bible was obviously gullible and naive and foolish, because anyone who has any intelligence knows that such things don't happen. Where did I get that idea that that's the way things were? And was I right in thinking of those things? And that's where we have to look at my overall picture of the world, and was I right to cling to it? And I also have to examine my own heart, and part of the issue comes back to that question that Jesus is confronting us with here, what do I want? And that's something that I had to wrestle with as well. So I agree. The fact that John gives this testimony doesn't settle the question. But in the light of those other things, I find his claim to be an eyewitness to be a credible one. It's coherent with what the rest of the Bible says. And then now I am confronted with a credible eyewitness that I have to decide, what am I going to do with what he said? So,
yeah, I agree. In that connection, it seems strange to me that people are afraid to read this, you know, supposed other gospels or mm-hmm. extra-canonical stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and we'll kind of push it under the rug and say, oh, this is evil stuff,
right,
without having read it, you know, and evaluating it. Because
right.
if it's really falsehood, then you should be able to read it and discern it as falsehood.
Yeah.
You know, the content of the book is really more important than who it's attributed to in that sense.
Right.
You know, just because it says, oh, Judas saw this and said this, it doesn't make it true. Look at the content of the book, and if it's talking about these whacked out, you know, passwords to get to other levels of reality,
right,
then, you know, maybe this is not so relevant to you.
Right. Right. No, that's exactly right. And what makes it more complicated, I mean, in your world and my world, where do you even learn about, unless you're involved in biblical scholarship, which you may be, but where do you even learn about stuff like the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Thomas and places like that? You learn about it like in documentaries on ABC or the Discovery Channel or something like that. And who are the people that they always bring forward to talk about those things? It's always the same people. You know, it's Elaine Pagel and people from the Jesus Seminar and stuff like that. You know, Jesus Seminar is really big on the Gospel of Thomas. That's like the most important book out of all of them. Okay, well, do you ever hear on those shows from the people who say, you know, the guys at the Jesus Seminar have severely misunderstood the place of the Gospel of Thomas? Do you hear from those scholars that would say Elaine Pagels is really distorting the picture of what's happening with the apocryphal literature? No, because they kind of have this agenda as to who it is they're going to listen to. So it makes it hard for us to even know, what am I dealing with when I'm looking at that stuff? So I just think, I agree with you. We need to be open to hearing what's out there, to knowing what's out there, and to considering the significance of it. But at the same time, we don't have to panic every time some scholar gets up and says, well, obviously Christianity is a crock. I said, well, there's a lot that goes into that, the worldview that has made that conclusion credible to that scholar, and I have to consider that before I even know what to do with it. So, yeah, that's tricky. Thanks. Dan?
In the first chapter of John, in the first few verses, we talk about the Logos, and mm-hmm. it goes into John talking about himself, it seems, where it says, there came a man sent from God whose name was John, and then he talks about his ministry and his what he saw, and then it goes back into there was a true light which coming into the world enlightens every man, and I assume he's talking about Jesus then? Or does he go back into using the word logos again?
Well, that's where it's kind of hard. It gets mixed together. I mean, the light, he switched from talking about the logos to talking about the light. And if you look at John 1 from verse 6, by the way, this John there I think is John the Baptist, not John the person who wrote the gospel here. But the point in verse 6, what he wants to say is, and we talked about this when we looked at the story about John the Baptist, that John the Apostle is very, very determined, and he does it over and over again in a number of places, to make the point that John the Baptist was not the one, that John the Baptist pointed to the Messiah. He was not the most important person in this stuff. So in saying in 6 and 7, he came for a witness that he might bear witness of the light. He was not the light, but he came that he might bear witness of the light. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. Well, I think he's talking about Jesus there. I mean, John the Baptist came to give witness to the Messiah, the one who was the light of the world. And so what he goes on to say there, notice how there was the true light which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own. We're still talking about the light there in this case. And those who were his own did not receive him, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. So clearly, somehow, this light that John the Baptist is not, there is this other one who is the light. I think all through there, it seems to be pointing at Jesus, the one that he's about to talk about in this gospel. And it isn't until we get to 14 that we come back to the word logos, and the logos became flesh and dwelt among us. So Jesus, the logos becomes flesh, and the light dwelt among us, and you become a child of God by believing in his name. The light and the logos here are both, they're talking about the same thing, ultimately, I think. But it's tricky. If you go through and try to track the pronouns, I mean, this is, I've done this twice with folks in the microexegesis class at Gutenberg, where we've gone through John. And it's a fascinating exercise to try to go through and track the pronouns. Okay, now, who are we talking about here? And is it safe to say I'm talking about Jesus at this point? You know, you get to this point where I say, well, clearly I am. So where did that start? And how do I understand how I got to that spot? It's actually quite tricky. That's why I have a hard time putting the precise details together of what's happening in the prologue.
Do you ever wonder why John would include this kind of language then?
Absolutely. That's my first question. part of what bothers me about the philosophical logos kind of idea is that it's the only place in the Bible that I'm aware of that the word logos is used in that sense. And like I said, John uses the word logos 36 times throughout the rest of the gospel, and he never uses it again in that sense. So, I mean, it's not impossible that he would do that, but I just keep coming up short against that. Where did that come from? What made him think that people would know what the heck he's talking about when he said that in the first verse? And that's, it may be that there's just some background to this stuff that would make that clearer that we don't have, or I don't have, at least. That's what makes it tricky. But exactly, why that? What did he think people would hear when he said that? The people that he was writing to. And that's the tricky part. Okay, well, thanks. I'm done in John. Next week, Jack is supposed to be teaching. I hope he's teaching. He said, I'll teach on whatever next week is. Is that okay with you? And several days later, I wrote back and said, yeah, I've decided that'd be good. You go ahead and start then. And I never actually have talked to him since I said, yeah, you go ahead. So if we show up next week and Jack's not here, then I guess he didn't get my message. And we'll figure out something to do. But.